The demon was active later that night also, picking on Simon again. It pretended to be a cat, and from inside the closet came the sounds of a cat meowing. Simon rushed to the closet door. We opened it up for him to see if, in fact, he had a new playmate, but it was just the demon playing tricks again. Actually, if you could have seen the disappointment on Simon's face when he found out there wasn't anything in there, well, it was pretty funny. Unfortunately for Janet and Jack, Simon's sad face would be about the only laugh the family would enjoy for many long days afterward. People are talking. Tuesday of that week, there was a phone call from the producer of the TV show People Are Talking, inviting the Smurls to return, but Janet gently declined. Though there was increasing talk of going public, no final decision had been made. Besides, as Janet joked to Jack that night, "People are talking anyway, whether we go on that show or not." The Smurls were well aware of how many people in West Pittston were talking about their problems. Friends told other friends, and soon the awareness level was very high. Sometimes when the demon was not making her life miserable, Janet liked to sit in the front window and stare out at the children playing in the street. At these moments, she knew a peace that was rarely hers these days, the peace of being a link in a vast chain. Her mother had been a link, and now she, as a mother, was a link. And someday the four girls would be links. She watched as Karen jumped rope and sang London Bridge. Janet wondered for how many decades, or perhaps even centuries, children had been singing London Bridge, and she delighted herself for the next 20 minutes, watching how the sun dappled the pavement and the grass and the shrubbery. This was August, and you could see the first hints of autumn in the brown-turning hills in the distance. The air was hot, but not too much so, and Janet, her head on the couch, allowed herself the luxury of drifting off to sleep, until the screams from upstairs jarred her from her slumber. She went up the stairs 2 at a time. Shannon had not been feeling well and had come in for a nap. When she reached Shannon's room, out of breath and terrified, Janet saw Shannon huddled in a corner, big tears streaking her cheeks.
"A man, Mommy,"
Shannon said.
"What man?"
"He came into the room and started taking things out of my toy box."
Janet went over and knelt next to her daughter, smoothed her hair, kissed her wet cheek.
"Honey, maybe you were dreaming it."
"I wasn't asleep, Mommy. I was playing. Anyway, he's come in here before."
"He has?"
Shannon nodded somberly.
"Can you describe this man for me, honey?"
"He's big, and he walks sort of funny, and his eyes are real dark, and it hurts to look at him. And he smells. He smells real bad."
"Has he tried to hurt you in any way?"
"He just looks at me, Mommy."
She put her head on Janet's shoulder and began crying softly.
"He scares me, Mommy. He scares me a lot."
Going public. By the time Jack got home that evening, Janet was on one of her half-and-half diets, half nicotine, half caffeine. As he stood in the kitchen doorway, observing how tightly wound his wife was, Jack sensed that she was approaching another crisis point. She turned from the window, and there were tears in her eyes.
"It was in Shannon's room again this afternoon," she said.
Jack swore. Very quietly, she said,
"It's time."
He did not have to ask what she was talking about.
"What if they laugh?"
"Then they laugh," Jack said.
"What if they call us crazy?"
"Then they call us crazy."
"What if they laugh at the children?"
The pain in his eyes was more than she could stand to look at. She dropped her gaze.
"I'm sorry I said that."
"No," he said. "No, you're right. Maybe they will laugh at the kids."
"That would be hard to stand."
"But you know what would be even harder?"
"What?"
"To watch it destroy us, one by one, and not to fight back every way we can." He touched her hand. Evening shadows were purple in the kitchen window. The stars were bright in the hazy wash of sky. "And that means exposing it."
That means forcing the diocese to get involved, and that means letting everybody in the community know what's going on here. Even if some people do laugh at us. He paused. You agree? She did not give her answer for a very long time, and when it came, it was not even a word. It was just a nod. A simple but profound nod. Lull before the storm. They sat up long into the night, making plans. In the morning, Janet would once again try the diocese. And then she would, if the diocese office refused to help, call a staff writer for the Wilkes-Barre Sunday Independent named Sandy Underwood. In the morning, following a night without any evidence of the demon, Janet rolled over and slid her arm around her husband's side.
This is sort of like the old days, she said sentimentally.
Peaceful, he said. Then she nudged him and laughed.
No, hurried.
She jumped out of bed and said,
Remember how we used to like to stay in bed till the very last minute, and then we'd have to rush around? Well, guess what time it is?
Jack rolled over and glanced at the clock. He had 45 minutes to get to work.
God, I really overslept.
He kept asking me to hit the snooze alarm.
He kissed her, laughed.
Great.
Then the laugh faded.
You remember everything you're supposed to do?
Right.
I sure hope the diocese just decides to go along and we don't have to go to the paper.
Stubbornly, Janet said,
I guess that'll be up to them.
He kissed her again and said, Good luck, honey.
I sure hope it works.
While Jack showered, Janet threw on a robe and went downstairs to fix his breakfast. Janet Smurl here recounts her experience with the diocese office. You phoned the office?
Yes.
And what were you told?
Basically, that they would do something to help us.
Did they define what that something was?
They certainly gave the impression that it would be something along the lines of sending a priest out.
So you didn't call the newspaper that day?
No.
Did a priest come out?
No.
Did you call the diocese back?
We talked about it, but then we began to think, what's the use? All your life you're raised to believe in the kindness of the church, and then you go through something like this. Well, it just drains you. That's the only way to put it. It drains you.
So eventually you did go to the press?
Not eventually, a few days later.
And you went because the church didn't offer its help?
That, and because of what happened to Jack.
And that was?
A succubus appeared for a second time, almost exactly 1 year after it had attacked the first time. It was devastating.
A second attack. The time was dawn. A round red summer sun was pushing up past clouds already hazy with pollutants, casting an almost bloody glow over the bedroom in which Janet and Jack Smurl slept. And then, abruptly, Jack was awake. A voluptuous young woman was on top of Jack, riding him in the position of sexual domination. Despite her beauty and the pleasure she was obviously enjoying, her eyes remained a shocking and sickly neon green. Next to him, Janet slept. Jack knew that she was in a deep psychic sleep. Despite his prayers, the succubus would not be contained. Still in the form of the beautiful young woman whose alabaster nakedness was only complemented by the reddish glow of the rising sun, the succubus plundered Jack sexually, sinking down and then moving up on him several times. He exhorted the demon to be gone, but he found that he was unable to move or speak. And the succubus continued, mounting him once more, hair flying wildly, neon green eyes growing larger and more lurid as its mouth ran with the drool of satisfaction. The curious thing was that for all the movement, and the succubus put on a dazzling show full of tricks, Jack felt no sexual sensation at all. He lay there and simply watched the demon perform. And then it was over. One moment he had been the pawn of Satan himself, and now he lay covered with a gelatinous, sticky mess, the same stuff the night hag had left on him when it had reached a climax during its first attack. Sickened by what had happened, Jack got up from the bed and went into the shower where he stood for nearly half an hour. He scrubbed himself until his skin ached. Out of the shower, he covered himself with talcum powder and aqua velva. Then he began brushing his teeth, obsessively, to the point that his gums began to bleed. The Interview. Following the reappearance of the succubus, Jack Smurl went down to the breakfast table and quietly said, "I'd like you to call that reporter Sandy Underwood this morning." And so it was arranged. What they'd put off for so long, what appeared to be the only thing left for the Smurls, going public and putting themselves at the mercy of the public and the media. Janet,
you always hear that confession is good for the soul, and that you reach a catharsis when you tell somebody something that has been troubling you a long time. But in this case, in the case of the interview, I mean, we were just kind of going through the motions. Sandy was very nice. She took us seriously and asked very intelligent follow-up questions and gave us plenty of time to clarify what we said.
Jack, Ed and Lorraine backed up everything we said. They were very helpful to us, very helpful. I have to smile when I think back to some of Sandy's expressions. We gave her a lot of material, probably a lot more than she thought she'd get, and Ed and Lorraine gave her a very good grounding in the whole psychic experience. Janet,
I was surprised by how sympathetic and attentive to detail she was. She really wasn't just looking for a sensational story. She wanted the truth to be told, and she was willing to let us tell it our way, and so we did. We covered most of the high points of the infestation since the beginning.
Jack,
there was an inherent plea in the story for anybody who could help us to please step forward and do so. We also made a very strong appeal for the diocese to get involved again.
Janet,
I suppose we had mixed feelings when it was all over, as if we didn't know quite how to feel. On the one hand, it did feel good to just tell the facts as they'd happened, and use our real name and address. That was one reason we'd decided to go with the newspaper instead of TV. We felt it would give us an opportunity to be more cautious, and to make sure that what we said was what we wanted to say. When you get in front of a camera, you just can't believe the pressure that's on you.
Jack, after the interview was finished, we sat with the Warrens and talked about what we might anticipate from the public. And we seemed to swing from optimism to pessimism. Ed kept reminding us that the public could be fickle and unpredictable, but that the thing we had to keep our eye on was that we'd come clean, as it were, and that we should feel better about that. And I guess we did, really. There had been a cleansing effect in telling our story.
Janet, the story was due to come out on Sunday, August 17th. All we could do at this point was wait and see what the reaction was. As Jack said, we'd have these great highs and then great lows trying to figure out how people were going to react to us.
Jack, we decided to go away for the weekend, to Cinnaminson, to visit my sister and her husband, Cindy and James Coleman. The demon, to remind us that nothing had changed where it was concerned, woke me up in the middle of the night with a burning smell. I checked the Coleman house and found no fire or anything. Finally, I went back to bed. There were some hangings, just enough to annoy me, but eventually I got to sleep. Overall, we had a very nice weekend, Mom and Dad joining us for their 49th wedding anniversary. The wood-burning smell came one more time, and I checked it out, remembering that the Warrens had said that if we smelled fire, we should check it out because this smell is often created by demons, and while it's usually manufactured, there is the dim possibility that one time in a million it might actually be a fire. But it wasn't. So we went back to enjoying our weekend.
Janet, 49 years of marriage is really something to celebrate, and we did. It was one of the loveliest weekends we've ever had. None of us said much about the newspaper article that was going to appear. We just decided to wait till we got back home to see what happened. We'd know soon enough.
On the drive back home, the windows rolled down in the van, the rolling green countryside serene at dusk. Janet said,
"Wouldn't it be nice if we found somebody waiting on our doorstep who told us exactly what to do to get rid of the demon?"
Jack laughed and patted her knee. "You don't want much, do you?" Notoriety. Understanding, compassion, a solution to their dilemma. These were the things the Smurls had hoped that publicity would bring them. In fact, it brought them just the opposite.
On the Sunday night, when they returned from John's and Mary's anniversary celebration, they sensed an uneasiness in the neighborhood. Two of the girls remarked on this fact.
"Something feels weird, Mom,"
Dawn said as the family unloaded things from the camper and brought them inside the house.
"Oh, it's just your imagination, hon,"
Janet said, not wanting to admit that she felt the same inexplicable anxiety. Washing up 20 minutes later, Janet happened to glance out the window. Immediately, she called for Jack. Her husband, always alert to trouble, appeared almost instantly.
"Everything all right?" he asked. "Look outside."
Jack walked over to the window and parted the frilly blue chintz curtains.
"The car," Janet said.
"The black Dodge?"
"Yes."
"What about it?"
"It's been sitting there for 10 minutes.
"Wonder why?"
"There's three of them."
"Three of who?"
"Teenage boys. Two in the front seat and one in the back. And they take turns pointing to our house."
An unpleasant awareness dawned in Jack.
"The article this morning."
"Right.
My God. Our house," Janet said, "is going to become a tourist attraction."
Janet's prediction came true. In the course of the next week, the Smurl family logged more than 200 calls from journalists of every stripe. Newspapers, television, both local and national, radio, both local and national, wire services, and supermarket tabloids. And the three teenage boys, sitting in a black Dodge, pointing to the house, proved to be only the start. Day and night, cars filled with gawking, pointing people crawled past the duplex. Some of the faces reflected the gravity of the Smurls' situation. Others smirked or scoffed. The street itself was beginning to resemble the parking lot of a major public event, the event being housed inside the Smurl duplex. By Friday, those who merely drove by and pointed had been replaced by a more brazen breed of onlooker. These people brought beer, soda, and sandwiches and camped out on the sidewalk or on the neighbors' front lawns. Some even climbed a tree in front of the house and tried to get onto the porch to take a look inside the house from the upstairs windows. A policeman told a local reporter, "This is like a mixture of a rock concert and a religious event. You've got people out here purely as a lark, but you've also got people who are screaming and passing out and claiming that they see all sorts of sights inside the Smurl house. There are some pretty scary people here, and that's why I feel sorry for the Smurls. This is the kind of crowd that can turn ugly very quickly, with just the right incentive." 24 hours a day, the spectators continued to move past the duplex. They came in shiny new Buicks and rusted old Plymouths, in sporty little Toyota trucks, and on sleek black Harley-Davidson motorcycles. Some pointed, some smirked, some blessed themselves. They were young and old, white and black, rich and poor. Some of them went around the block many times, and some found a place from which they could sit or stand in the baking heat and observe the house. West Pittston had never seen anything like this. As one town official told a network television reporter, "This is the largest private event in West Pittston's history. By Thursday of this week, more than 1,600 cars drove past the Smurl household every day." But that was only the beginning. Cars and campers from virtually every state in the Union have been parking all over West Pittston, and their owners have walked over to the Smurl house. There have even been fights among the onlookers to see who got closest to the house. It's been a total zoo, so much so that on Thursday night we ordered the police to barricade the entire street. It got that bad. Among the thousands who had thronged to the duplex on West Pittston were teenagers who hurled beer bottles at the house and called out filthy names. A motorcycle gang with occult symbols on their jackets and menace in their eyes, and some college students who thought it was funny to walk by with big ghetto blaster radios and play Ghostbusters. But this wasn't the only attention the family was attracting. By now, Janet and Jack Smurl had become instant celebrities. Throughout the United States, major daily newspapers carried their story and their photo. From the New York Post to national television news shows, the Smurls had become a major story. Of those reporters invited into the Smurl home, two reported supernatural experiences of their own while inside the house, which only heightened the impact of their stories. One complained of bitterly freezing temperatures and another of a sickening, fetid odor. It didn't take long for reporters to understand that what was going on here was both serious and real. By week's end, even more reporters had joined the fray and were turning out Smurl copy. As Janet Smurl would remark later,
"We've actually paid two prices.
the haunting itself, and the loss of our privacy. I can't tell what that first week was like. We were literally prisoners inside our own house, and some of the reporters were very insulting, questioning not just our motives, but our sanity. It only increased the stress. Fortunately, we did meet a few good people, among them a woman named Megan Cosgrove.
Ed Warren.
Over the years, Lorraine and I had seen many supernatural events turn into media events, most notably the Brookfield, Connecticut case with its resultant murder trial. But we had seen none that had attracted such sheer frenzy. Janet and Jack met both types of reporters, the good and the bad. The former was sympathetic, methodical, open-minded. The latter, one of the most sensational story they could get, even if it presented the Smurls in a bad light. Just as the more cynical reporters depressed Janet and Jack, so did the crowds. There was an ugly aspect to it all. The sun beating down, a sense of madness in the eyes of the hot, sweaty gawkers, and even contempt in some of their voices, as if they were demanding that the Smurls prove to them that satanic forces were in fact at work here. Lorraine and I even had words with some of the spectators. We made the mistake of simply asking a few of the pushier ones to move off the lawn and let the family have its privacy. Some of them, soaked with sweat, smelling of beer, challenged our right to make our request. It was at this moment that I saw how the demon was turning all this into yet another form of punishment for the Smurls. Looking out your window to find a stranger peering in is a very unnerving experience, and one the Smurls would suffer for months. Fortunately, among the vast media audience was a 38-year-old woman named Megan Cosgrove, who happened to work at the same plant where Jack did. It was she who contacted the Smurls and told them of a remarkable woman who communicated frequently with the supernatural world through a spirit she could contact at will. The woman's name was Betty Ann Moore, and she came over to the Smurl house on Thursday, August 21st. The upshot was stunning and provided a key clue to our ongoing investigation.
Janet. Megan was very impressive, warm but businesslike. Shortly after she sat down on the couch, we saw her give a start. I asked her what was wrong, and Megan said that something sharp but invisible had poked her in the eye, like a human thumb. Then, as she was wiping the tears from her eyes, her head jerked up and she pointed to something by the staircase. We asked her what it was, and she then proceeded to describe perfectly the black form that had haunted us for nearly 2 years. Her eye continued to swell. Finally, she had to go home and put an ice pack on it. She returned later that night with Betty Ann Moore, who had a very serious aura about her. We could see that she was very aware of what was going on here and was also very concerned. She asked to be taken through all the rooms in the house and then down into the basement, which was where she came into contact with a spirit named Abigail. Betty Ann was in a state of trance, her eyes closed and her fingers trembling. She said,
"Abigail is elderly, and she's either senile or confused, but she isn't harmful."
Then Betty Ann went on to describe Abigail in exactly the same terms Lorraine had months earlier. 20 minutes later, when Betty Ann asked to be taken to the middle bedroom upstairs, we saw how exactly her sense of the haunting matched Lorraine's, because Betty Ann then started to describe another spirit she was seeing, a man with a mustache named Patrick, who she said had died here but was afraid to return to the other side. Betty Ann lost in another trance, then began to give us some background on Patrick. He was a man who often beat his wife, Elizabeth, somewhere near the Smurl property before the house was built. This was sometime in the 19th century. Whenever Elizabeth became afraid of Patrick, she became involved with another man. One day Patrick came home unexpectedly and found Elizabeth in the embrace of her lover. He killed both of them, strangling Elizabeth and beating the man to death with his fists. Betty Ann then described how Patrick was beaten by a mob and then hung for the murders. And then she turned to me and said something we'd never expected.
"Janet, you look like Elizabeth. Patrick thinks Jack is your lover and he wants you and Jack separated."
As she told us this, a vase began to rattle and then sharp rappings were heard in the wall. Betty Ann in a strange, deep voice began to implore Patrick to go to the other side, but she told us that he was afraid he'd be punished if he crossed into the other realm. When Betty Ann came out of her trance, she said very matter-of-factly,
"Patrick doesn't want to leave this house. It will be very difficult to get rid of him."
Then Betty Ann paused, looking very distressed, and said,
"But that isn't the worst news. There's more, I'm afraid."
She shook her head, almost as if she were afraid to give voice to what she was thinking.
"There's a third earthbound spirit here. It could be either a man or a woman, I'm not sure. But whatever it is, it's violent and vicious and means to harm you."
She then explained that this spirit was insane, and if it were alive today, would be institutionalized in a mental hospital.
"This is the malevolent spirit that controls Patrick and continues to urge him to do violence. This is the spirit that wants the demon to commit the ultimate atrocity, possession of one or both of you."
Her eyes stared at midpoint in the room, and her voice became even huskier.
"Then there is the demon itself, a direct disciple of the devil's. I sense it throughout the house, everywhere."
The look that passed between Janet and Jack was heartbreaking, because once again the most disturbing possibility had been mentioned, the specter of possession, of a demon literally taking control of a living person. Would it be one of them? One of their children? No mercy. In the following 2 weeks, the Smurl family saw the human species at its best and worst. Many people stopped by the house and offered them rosaries and other religious items. From all over the world came cards and letters wishing them well, and including special prayers and suggestions about how to handle their haunting. Clergymen of every denomination contacted them and offered them prayers, all except, for the present anyway, a representative of the diocese. Jack. One thing that was reassuring about the mail was that we heard from so many people who had had experiences similar to ours. And I mean people from everywhere, Brazil, Puerto Rico, the Netherlands, and many other European countries. That made us feel a little less isolated. Janet.
There was no rest for us. During this time when the press surrounded our house, the haunting continued, usually in the form of rappings or the fleeting appearance of the dark form, while down on our kitchen table the telegrams and messages stacked up. We put them in grocery bags and in boxes and piled them in the kitchen closet. We just kept running out of room. Fortunately, since most of the messages contained information and good wishes and religious medals, they were encouraging rather than discouraging.
But certainly, there were things to be discouraged about. Even on Friday, August 22nd, when West Pittston recorded a significant amount of rainfall, the crowds were merciless, pushing closer, closer, trying for a look inside or to touch family members as they tried to leave the house. Jack.
Some people were convinced we were holy, and other people were convinced we were messengers from Satan. The latter got very bad when we heard from a coven of witches who wanted to come over and meet us. That's just what we needed at that time. Witches.
The people on the street began to display even more bizarre behavior. Janet.
Two incidents really disturbed us. One morning a man holding a handgun drove past our house very slowly. We happened to be looking out the window at the time, and we ducked down, afraid of what he might do. Another man got very close to our front door with a huge machete in his hand. Luckily, several people in the crowd shouted at him, and he ran off. But of all the things that happened during the time of the crowds, probably the most depressing was the phone call from a woman I'd considered a friendly acquaintance, if not an outright friend of mine. Our daughters were in school together. School would start in a few weeks, but she called me one evening and said that she didn't want her daughter to be friends with mine anymore. That really hurt.
The reporters had become so overwhelming in their numbers and demands that on August 23rd at 2 p.m., exactly, Janet and Jack stood on their back porch and read a prepared statement to the throng. "As reporters, you can see that this situation has gotten completely out of hand. No one is helping us with our problems. We can't keep up with all the calls and letters,
and we don't know how to handle this situation. Please say a prayer for us in church."
Temporarily, at least, the reporters pulled back from the house and gave the Smurls some privacy. But that privacy was not to last long. The haunting widens. The call came at dusk. The caller was a neighbor. She was not angry, but she was afraid. Very afraid.
"Janet, it's affecting all of us," she said. "I know,"
Janet said, fearing what her friend was going to say next.
"Six separate houses, including mine. Supernatural things, you mean? Rappings, bad odors, screams. I'm sorry,"
Janet said, feeling the last of her energy and hope draining from her. Now the demon was using their friends and neighbors to make the haunting even more terrible.
The woman said, "I didn't call to make you feel bad, Janet. I just wondered if there was any advice you could give us."
Janet smiled bitterly to herself.
"If I had any to give, I would have taken it myself a long time ago."
The woman laughed sadly.
"I guess that's right, isn't it? I'll pray for you," Janet said.
That night, watching TV, the Smurls saw something that surprised them. The anchorman on WNEP announced that the station had taken a poll to see how many viewers believed the Smurls' story and how many viewers disbelieved it. The results were amazing. 75% believed the Smurls, and only 25% doubted them.
"Janet, I suppose it was silly to feel good about that, but after everything that had happened to us, it was nice to know that the majority of people in the community saw us as sane and honest. It was comforting to know that."
In the middle of the night, Jack Smurl got up to go to the bathroom. Before going back to bed, he glanced at himself in the mirror. What he saw caused him to jerk backward, as if he'd been shot. The face in the mirror belonged not to him, but to a decomposed man whose flesh hung in tatters and whose eyes burned with the sorrow of the newly dead. Then the image was gone and his own face was back. For the remainder of the night, Jack lay in bed thinking of one word again and again: possession. Is that what he would look like if the demon succeeded in completing the fourth stage of the haunting? Possession? He thought of what Betty Ann had described to him. He thought of what Ed and Lorraine Warren had said was the demon's ultimate goal. Then he thought of the ghoul he'd seen in the mirror, the feral, glistening eyes, the rotting flesh, the twisted skeletal hand. Had it been a premonition of what he himself was about to become? Daylight was a long time coming. Lorraine Warren.
"At long last, Ed and I were glad to see that at least one goal of the Smurls going public had paid off. They heard from the diocese office, though unfortunately not in the way they'd hoped. Janet told us, Father Doyle from the Diocese Bureau was not pleased that we'd given our story to the press. He said that we should have contacted the church first, as if we hadn't. We simply told him that, given all the things that were going on, we couldn't wait any longer, that our lives were now hanging in the balance. The diocese office was not pleased that they were getting so many calls from reporters asking about our case. Finally, a few days after the call from Father Doyle, a priest came out and talked to us. We told him about the previous exorcisms and how the diocese had refused to help. We also expressed our resentment that a newspaper story the day before had given the impression that we'd never tried to contact the Scranton Diocese office until recently. He was very polite, but he was careful to express neither belief nor disbelief in what we told him. At the end of the interview, he was very cordial and said he'd get back to us. We did not hear from the Scranton Diocese for several days, though meanwhile a priest from another diocese offered to perform an exorcism. Then he called back and said that the Scranton office, which had heard of his offer, called him and said that for him to come into the Scranton Diocese would break protocol.
Wonderful.
By this time, Ed and I had begun to chart the subtle but certain shift in ferocity the supernatural attacks displayed. We also noted Jack's somewhat different demeanor: pale skin, anxious glances, and what appeared to be his clinical depression. This worried us greatly. We discussed this with Tammy Anderson, a team member of ours who was also a detective with the Bridgeport, Connecticut Police Department, and she went and visited the Smurls. She confirmed our fears about Jack's condition. Though we didn't use the word with Tammy, what we were concerned about was that the demon,
which might well be jealous of Jack, seeing him as a rival for Janet's love, might in fact be in the process of trying to possess him. There was no doubt that drastic action had to be taken, and quickly. We spent 2 long days brainstorming with team members. The result was a plan for a mass exorcism that would involve several priests. To tell the Smurls of our plan, Dr. Walter Hummel, a former medical examiner now in private practice, and his wife Sarah of Greenwich, Connecticut, went to the Smurl duplex. Dr. Hummel, who has been our friend for more than 20 years and who has worked with us on many cases, reported back to us that he was quite moved by his interview with Janet and Jack, and that what made the situation so startling for him was that the haunting was not limited, as it usually was, to just a few people, but extended to dozens of people who were, in various respects, linked to the Smurls. While we were talking to the doctor and his wife, the phone rang. Ed answered it in the other room. When he came back, he looked upset. He said, "I'm told the Scranton Diocese isn't going to help us with our mass exorcism." He didn't have to say any more than that. At the moment, that was about the worst news the Smurls could have received. The diocese declines. True to the priest's promise, the Scranton Diocese finally did call the Smurls back. Indeed, the office requested that Janet and Jack meet with Father Doyle in his own office the following afternoon. The Smurls were very hopeful that Father Doyle had good news for them, buoyed as they were by the fact that, as autumn began to touch the trees and thin the summer sunlight, the crowds camped outside had thinned somewhat. Not that the press itself had lost interest in the Smurl story. "Janet, we were still on the news several times a week, and we lost count of how many hundreds of news stories had been filed about us. But happily, some of the freakish nature of the investigation had quieted down. With the call from the diocese, we had new hope that some serious steps were finally going to be taken, and that perhaps our problem would be resolved once and for all." 24 hours later, Janet and Jack sat in Father Doyle's office, explaining the mass exorcism plan the Warrens had suggested. The Smurls were anxious for the diocese to talk to the Warrens. The Chancellor, also present at the meeting, stunned the couple when he said that there was no reason whatsoever to talk to the Warrens, because from this point on the diocese itself was taking over the investigation.
"But Ed and Lorraine have been a tremendous help to us," Janet said. "We haven't met anybody who understands the supernatural better than the Warrens."
But the Chancellor shook his head. The diocese would be taking over the investigation. As far as the official church was concerned, the Warrens were no longer involved. Ed Warren. "Lorraine and I were not surprised at the response of the church. Like all institutions, Catholicism has its own priorities, and obviously in this case, the Chancellor felt that the most important thing to do was quiet the negative publicity over how the diocese office had treated the Smurls in the past. Our one reservation was that we knew how the church worked in such cases, the object being to find a scientific explanation for the hauntings whenever possible, sometimes to the exclusion of the real explanation. As for the Smurls, nothing got any easier for them." Interview with Aaron Turner. "You've been a good friend of the Smurls."
"Very good. They're wonderful people."
"Would you tell us how you became involved in the haunting?"
It was because I telephoned Janet over a weekend."
"Could you explain?"
"Well, they'd gone camping, which I hadn't known about, so I just kept calling to see if she wanted to get together and do some shopping."
"Would you elaborate on what happened then?"
"This little girl answered."
"Little girl?"
"Yes. She sounded as if she was probably 7 or 8, and then she'd laugh."
"Laugh?"
"That was the eeriest part, her laugh. She'd say, 'They don't live here anymore,' and then she'd hang up. I called 6 or 7 times that weekend. I just couldn't believe what I was hearing. But the little girl would always answer. I even called the operator to verify the number, but she said that it was the Smurl house I was calling."
"And you told Janet?"
"Sure, right away. She got as scared as I was. With everything her family was going through, they didn't need some new kind of trouble like this."
"Jack, despite the efforts of the church to carry on its own plans,
Janet and I felt that it was important for us to carry on with ours, namely a prayer meeting organized by our friends and by 50 women and 20 men of the Sacred Heart League of St. Mary's Annunciation in Kingston, which is near West Pittston. By the time these people and other family friends filled the Smurl home, the mood was solemn. The days of the circus-like atmosphere of press and publicity had faded, and now the Smurls were in a new era, trying to stop the demon from taking possession. The house was transformed. Vigil candles were set out every few feet and then lit, bathing the entire house in a shadowy glow as the voices of faithful rose in communal prayer, like the one the early Christians said in the catacombs. In some eyes you could see tears, on some lips smiles, because you had the sense that the devil was being driven out. At a gathering later on, two people even reported seeing an image of the Blessed Virgin somehow being projected onto one of the walls, a faint but perfect impression of the Holy Mother bringing her own special powers to help drive out the demon. Janet,
it was a very moving spectacle. All these concerned, caring people doing everything they could to help us. You could feel the love, you really could. I had tears in my eyes most of the time, and the house looked so beautiful with the vigil lights splashing different colors across everything.
The faithful stayed till very late, but after several hours of calm and quiet, the television in the Smurl's bedroom began to rock from side to side, and pounding in the walls became so violent that Janet had to cover her ears. Sobbing, she said,
"Are they ever going to leave us alone? Ever?"
Ed Warren. Janet and Jack continued to call us frequently as we waited to see what the church would do. They also continued to hear from religious people from all over the world, some responsible and tender people, others strident and threatening. Finally, they even heard from the Scranton Diocese, which agreed to dispatch a priest in the person of Monsignor Joseph Brown. It would be the Monsignor's task to stay at the Smurl's residence overnight and see if he could find any hard evidence of a true haunting. Though we said nothing at the time to Janet and Jack as they excitedly told us about this, we knew that the demon would probably choose not to expose itself, thereby making the Smurls appear to the priest as either frauds or hysterics. And that's what happened. Diocesan priests came to the Smurl house a few times, some to stay overnight while the family slept, but none heard or saw anything that endorsed the notion that a bona fide haunting was going on here. Jack. That was the irony. We'd struggled so long to get the church involved, but we'd never thought about it turning out this way. Here we'd made all these claims, and the church couldn't find any proof to back them up. Things were going so badly that Jack had lost 20 pounds since the family had gone public. Janet had not only lost weight, 14 pounds, she'd also developed an ulcer. One day, as we were talking to Janet and Jack in their living room, I began to sense the presence of the demon itself. Once again, in a way I cannot articulate, I sensed that it had grown bolder and stronger, and was ready to strike. Lorraine saw how upset I was, and as soon as we'd reached the van, she said, "You look terrible. As soon as we get back, I'm going to call Father McKenna." We rushed back to our home and got the priest on the phone. Ugly Incident. As if to remind the Smurls that their enemies were not just of the supernatural variety, one night they were sitting home watching TV when Jack heard a car slow down in front of the duplex. By now, of course, he'd gotten used to people cruising by in slow-moving cars. Even though public attention had dwindled, there was still a steady flow of the curious.
"What is it, honey?"
Janet asked. "Somebody parked out there."
"Circus time again," Janet said.
But her gentle sarcasm ended abruptly when a beer bottle came hurtling through their front window. Jack. All the girls were crying and huddled in the corner. It was like there were two sieges going on, the demon and a few sick people who hated us for some inexplicable reason. I got a look at the people, they were teenagers. And I called the police, but the incident really left its mark on the family, scared us, and made us very angry all over again. And so we had to rely more than ever on Ed's and Lorraine's plan to try to end the infestation. I can't say we had much hope at that point, but hope was about all we had. The Final Exorcism.
Not even Father McKenna could summon many smiles on the day, a week later when he drove back to the Smurl residence and performed the third exorcism. Early in the morning, just before driving over, Father McKenna had said a special mass for the Smurls, and so, that done, the exorcism consisted of saying special prayers on both sides of the duplex, and then going through each room with holy water. This time the priest even blessed the backyard. Janet.
Father McKenna's face was so beautiful. You could see the concentration on it. He was, in effect, putting his own soul on the line for this to work.
There were no disruptions during this exorcism. So impassioned were Father McKenna's prayers that the demon seemed almost afraid to show itself. Finished, the priest once more started to his car, refusing the dinner the Smurls offered. Fasting was an integral part of the exorcism ritual, the priest reminded them. What followed was an almost daily pilgrimage to the Smurl residence, this time by friends and relatives of the Smurl family, including the men of the Sacred Heart League. Prayers and vigil candles were strong on the air. It was Ed's and Lorraine's idea to drown the demon in prayer following the exorcism, and it began to work. Jack.
You could feel something. The way air changes after a storm has passed. At first, we were almost afraid to hope that the prayers and the vigil would help in any lasting way, but overall the days following the exorcism were great. We hadn't been that relaxed in over 2 years.
The nice thing was, for the time being, there would be no surprises, at least not bad ones. Indeed, the one surprise the Smurls received in late September was a very pleasant one. Ed Warren.
Janet called us a few minutes after she woke up.
You won't believe it, she said to Lorraine and me. The whole house is filled with the scent of roses again.
Even I had to take that as a good sign. And I say even I because experience has shown that it is sensible to be skeptical where hauntings are concerned. Under most circumstances, it takes a great deal of effort, either planned or inadvertent, to stir the demon, and then it is nearly impossible to get rid of it. Still, I had to admit that the extraordinary holiness shown by Father McKenna and the daily prayers taking place at the Smurl house were apparently quelling the forces of darkness. And things only got better.
Janet.
We just couldn't believe it. 2, then 3, then 4 weeks went by without a single incident. Every few days, the smell of roses would return to one or two of the rooms, and our house would be filled with the sound of prayer. It was wonderful, and you could see the wonder on the faces of our children. They started having friends over again and planning parties, and you could hear their laughter all over the house.
The press, of course, was still interested in what was going on at the Smurl house and asked for a report. In a joint statement on October 28th, Janet and Jack Smurl announced, "For several weeks now, all has been quiet in our house, and it would appear that our problem has been resolved."
A spokesperson for the diocese said that after an intensive investigation, the diocese had reached no conclusions and had taken no position on the case, but that, since the Smurls said the matter had been resolved, the diocese was closing its inquiry. Gray November came, but for the Smurls, it had the feel of the most beautiful of springs, because in the walls there were no wrappings. On the air there was no grim slaughterhouse odor. On the faces of their children were the normal smiles of youth.
Jack.
We didn't quit praying, of course. If anything, we became even more religious. We didn't want our newfound freedom to be destroyed again.
The Return.
After Thanksgiving, the Smurl family began planning for Christmas. They had already been given the best gift of all, their peace of mind. But now they wanted to plan a holiday that would let them thank God and also celebrate their unity as a family. It was a good time for them. Janet and Jack began regaining some of their lost weight, and they both eased into spending even more time with the girls and school activities. No, you couldn't ask for a better time than this. Jack enjoyed resting in his favorite chair. Sometimes, watching TV, he'd doze off, especially following a hard day's work. Tonight, he'd done exactly that, slept for perhaps half an hour. Now he was awake again. Johnny Carson was on, the monologue particularly funny tonight. Jack decided watching Carson would be a good way to get completely relaxed before going upstairs to bed. With the holidays less than 2 weeks away, the living room was aglow with lights from the Christmas tree, beautiful soft greens and yellows and reds. The air was scented with the clean tang of the fir tree itself. Then he clicked off the TV and began to pray. As he did so, he glanced up at the mirror over the sofa, and he saw it, the black, caped form whose presence had announced the haunting to begin with. Only this time there was a difference. Jack sensed the demon beckoning to him, summoning him, really, and he knew instantly what this signified. The final, dreaded stage of a haunting. Possession. He bolted from the chair, keeping his rosary tight in his hand. The black figure started toward him. Jack scrambled to the stairs and started backing up them slowly so he could keep the demon in his sight. The black figure grew even closer. Jack's heart hammered. He was drenched in sweat. Twice he stumbled and desperately clutched at the banister for support. The caped figure continued to move closer, closer. Then Jack, sensing that the demon would lunge at him, took his rosary and showed it to the creature. He also began to say over and over the prayer the Warrens had taught him. Only gradually did the demon withdraw. Jack's voice got louder and louder, his prayer more and more intense. Then, before his eyes, the dark creature faded into the wall and disappeared. Jack determined not to mention this to his wife or the children. He wanted them to think that things were still fine, that the scent of roses would stay, and that life would be simple and good and normal. But in the middle of the night, bangings broke out in the walls, and on John and Mary's side of the duplex the flooring trembled violently, as if an earthquake were taking place. The haunting had begun all over again. There could be no mistake about it. The demon and spirits had only been waiting for the opportunity to strike again and continue their unrelenting assault on the family. With their return, the entities used some new tactics. The flooring on John and Mary's side trembled violently, and when Mary was in the bathroom, a distorted white mass about 3 feet tall and covered with oozing pustules rushed past her and disappeared into the vanity. Over the next weeks, there was sharp decline in the health of the senior Smurls, and the Smurl children had slipped back into anxiety and depression. Every night now, the family was haunted. By New Year's Day, 1987, an atmosphere of terror once more filled the Smurl house. On January 10th, the girls went to bed early, and Janet and Jack soon followed. They had been asleep less than half an hour when the pounding began. If you listened carefully, you could hear not only the invisible fists of old, but strange new whispers and traces of laughter. Demonic laughter. Janet and Jack lay awake all night, holding hands and weeping. Ed and Lorraine Warren. Today, the haunting continues. We wish we knew why. Even more, we wish we had a solution. Would a permanent move help the Smurls, perhaps? Will the haunting continue all their lives? Possibly. Will the family be able to withstand the stress? We hope so. As demonologists, neither of us can ever recall a haunting of such tenacity. The demon simply will not be displaced. It has focused its very essence on the Smurl family and will not let go. We are still in contact with the Smurls, usually once a week. So is Father, now Bishop McKenna. Occasionally, one of our research team has an idea, which we try, but to date, nothing has been successful. There is still, of course, the terrible prospect of possession, for that is the ultimate goal of all hauntings. Jack in particular is well aware of this, for it is Jack whom the demon seems most to despise. As for any closing words of optimism, we can only reflect on what Bishop McKenna has said. That the experience of the Smurls should erase any doubts non-believers might have that the spirit world exists. All you have to do is stand in the Smurl home to know that demons are a very real and very dangerous part of reality. The biggest gift we can offer the Smurls is our continued faith and our prayers that someday their burden will be lifted and the scent of roses will fill their home permanently. Today. The Smurls live as quietly as possible, liked and admired for what they have endured, fearful that the haunting that has plagued them will never end. To be sure, there is laughter in the Smurl household. There is also pride and hope and real joy. But always in the corners of the night, there is the prospect that the demon will come and perhaps one day dominate their lives even more terribly. There is no doubt that their story is true.
Too many witnesses and too much corroboration have supported their ominous tale. All that feeds their hope these days is that God, in his kindness, will end their ordeal. Soon. Postscript. Just as this book went to press, the Smurl family moved from the Chase Street duplex. They now live in a quiet nearby Pennsylvania suburban community. The End. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Haunted, One Family's Nightmare, by Ed and Lorraine Warren, Robert Kern, with Jack and Janet Smurl. Read for you by Todd Habercorn, produced by David Zindel. Text copyright 1992 by Robert Kern, Jack and Janet Smurl, and Ed and Lorraine Warren. Production copyright 2016, Gray Malkin Media. All rights reserved. For more information about this title and Ed and Lorraine Warren, visit graymalkin.com. That's GRAYMALKIN.com. Thank you for listening.